You are listening to Clearly Connected, a podcast that inspires new ways to reconnect to ourselves, to others, and to our natural environment in a world where so many of us are disconnected. I'm your host, Carrie Doan. I'm a pleasure coach, an entrepreneur, an advocate for change, and a believer in all things possible. Today, I'm excited to have my guest, Kelly Sundsvold, to share her courageous story of what it was like to leave a toxic religious community that left her both traumatized and confused about her own self-worth. Kelly and I discussed the journey towards authenticity and the overwhelming benefits of choosing a path that calls us home to ourselves. I'm so glad you're here to join us as we shift toward a life of authentic living and move closer to a more deeply connected way of living. Welcome, welcome, everyone. Today, I'm excited about this conversation because it centers around something that I talk about all the time, which is authenticity and what it means to live a life of integrity and not simply the path that society or the world tells us to live. So I get the honor and the privilege to share this discussion with someone who has grown very dear to my heart in recent months, Kelly Sundsvold of Gold Bear Media. And so before we dive in, I want to give you an intro about my guest, Kelly. Kelly is, I think, a courageous woman who, having grown up in a fundamentally religious system, was able to deconstruct and break free from the toxic environment that she was in. And through that process, she learned how to heal herself and her traumatic past and really reconnect to who she is. And additionally, she's a marketing professional and CEO owner of Gold Bear Media, who focuses on helping business owners create comprehensive marketing strategies, websites, and social media profiles. So Kelly has been married to her husband, Sean, for 19 years, and they currently have 4 children together. And she also is a breast cancer survivor and a huge believer in early detection. She's overcome so much. And so, Kelly, I am just really thrilled to have you sharing your story and your insights today with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Carrie. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I just remember when I heard your story recently, I thought, oh my gosh, so much here. I think I'd love to hear it be highlighted more as a source of inspiration for people who are on this path of kind of reclaiming who they are. And so, you know, I'll ask you the question that I ask all of my guests at the beginning is, if you don't mind, to just tell us a little bit of your story. What was life like growing up? I already kind of alluded to the fact that you were in this religious system. So just kind of take us there and let us know what was it like growing up?
Yeah. So I was raised in the LCMS Lutheran Church. I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and was a huge Cowboys fan. A little tidbit of information. I'm not a Cowboys fan anymore. But separately aside, I grew up in what I would call generally like a happy household. I had a mom and a dad and a brother, but there was always some undertones of conflict, and there was some unresolved conflict that happened in the family. But that played into my story a little bit. But more importantly, we were part of the Lutheran Church, and the church that we went to would be what I would call a cult. It was very fundamentalist, very rules-based. Everyone had to act a certain way, be a certain way. If you didn't, you were sinning and shamed. So it was a very controlled environment. I was actually part of the school. I went to school there. Also, they had a like pre-K through 8th grade school that I was part of, and I went to school there from 1st grade through 8th grade. And I would say, like, in general, like, and I was a child, in general, I enjoyed my time there, but it really, like I said, it was really, really rules-based, and it it really did a disservice to my growth as a person, because it was so constricting. You know, I was there Monday through Friday at the school learning about catechism and the Bible, and everything had a religious slant, even our history lessons and science lessons. And then on Sunday, I was there as well. And I had confirmation, and we had after, you know, Wednesday services. And so it really was all encompassing for those 8 years of my life. So when I went to public school for ninth grade, it was a complete culture shock. I really had no concept of like same-sex marriage, of people dating, holding hands, kissing, oh my goodness, drugs. I really had no concept of really any of that because I just grew up in such a sheltered environment. So kind of flash forward, I was really had a hard thump when I hit public school. It just really was not a great time for me. I started kind of hanging out with some, you know, quote unquote, wrong kids, and, you know, was smoking in the bathroom and, you know, experimenting with different things. Cause I just wanted to fit in. And I felt like such a, I mean, it's a hard age anyways for kids, but I just felt like such an outcast. Mm-hmm. So I was part of a group, called, Ongoing Ambassadors for Christ. And they met on weekends, once a month, to a different area churches, to go out to neighborhoods and talk about Jesus. So we would knock on doors and we would ask people, you know, where do you believe that you're going to go when you die and why? And, you know, I look back on that and I'm just a little high school kid asking these grownups these loaded questions. And it just, man, it was so like, I just felt bad for like, I'm going to be worm food. And I just felt like just so bad for them. I was like, oh, I have to keep going. You know, at the time I was really passionate about this outreach. And during the summer, kind of getting to some of the, just sort of like abuse that happened, during the summer, we would go to nationwide locations. So we would go to like Illinois or, you know, San Antonio or something. Like we'd go to different, and all the people from this group would gather in one location. So when I was 16, I went to this location, and again, just sort of this, you know, lanky 16-year-old that, you know, was trying to fit in and, you know, really didn't understand life outside of the church. You know, and I'm on a church mission trip, and on the way home, there was one of our chaperones, a 27-year-old who sexually abused me, mm-hmm. and in the van on the way home. And it was horrific. I really had, and I was thinking about this morning. I was like kind of rehashing that and how completely unprepared I was for that moment. Mm-hmm. And it was really, it was shocking that, you know, how easily that could, happen. I think that's just what I walk away with, is like how easy it happened and how unstereotypical it happened. So I've gotten in a lot of conversations with people in the church who've been like, well, you know, if you're, you know, dressing in midriffs and going out to parties and, you know, drinking, like, yeah, you're gonna get in trouble with boys or whatever. But this is a situation where I was like, literally not asking for it, you know, and I didn't know what was happening. I was in a church van with people that I trusted and wearing pajama pants and a baggy shirt because we had to drive all night, you know, and there was nothing there was nothing that said that that should have happened to me in that moment.
Yes. Wow. Wow. I mean, I can't even imagine what that emotional experience was like for you. And especially at that age where you're just kind of trying to figure out life and figure out who you are. And then these things happen. Now, can I ask, were they actually blaming you for kind of bringing that onto yourself? Kind of how you were saying with the clothing and all of that, or?
Yes. Yes, they were. That was the crazy part about it, Carrie. Like they were, so we were in a suburban, like a big suburban, and we had, I think, five students, including myself, in the van, and then two chaperones. One was driving, and then the 27-year-old that was in the back seat with me. And they witnessed it. And the kids that were in the car, so I was 16 at the time, the other kids that were in the car were like a grade or two younger than me. And so when we got back, I just felt like dirty. Like we were driving from Illinois down to Texas. We dropped him off in Oklahoma and he got out. And I was like, hey, are you going to call me? Like, I was so confused by the moment. Like, it was just so like, I felt like crying. And I was like, what's going to happen next? And he was like, see you later. And he walked out and I've never seen him since. And so all the way from wherever we dropped him off in Oklahoma to Dallas, I was like shocked. Nobody talked to me. I mean, I know everyone in the car saw what had happened and didn't do anything about it. And I got home and just was crying. I just felt depressed and sad. And I just cried a lot. And it came out a couple months later. The boys who witnessed it in the van actually started making fun of me and told the rest of our youth group what had happened. And it got around to the boy that I was dating at the time. And he accused me of cheating on him and forced me to do the things that, you know, I had never done before meeting this 27-year-old. He forced me to do those things because if I did it with him, why can't I do it with my boyfriend? Mm. And so it just perpetuated the shame and the guilt. And it was just awful. I finally went to an adult that I trusted, who is, you know, somebody in my life that I really trusted. And they knew something had happened. And I started explaining it, but I was embarrassed. And I didn't have all the right words. And the response that was immediately said to me was, well, if you're going to act like a slut, you're going to get treated like a slut. And that shut that conversation down.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Can I just insert something here real quick?
Sure.
Because, yeah. So not only were you violated against your will, and not only were there witnesses who were silent about this, but also there is like a complete shirking of all responsibility of what was done, mm-hmm. and projecting the blame onto you.
Yes.
I mean, to me, that is layer upon layer upon layer of what would I call it? Like manipulation maybe, or just projecting the pain onto somebody, an innocent victim. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine like how much work it had to kind of like get through that. Okay. So you found this person that you trusted. They said that to you. And then what happened after that?
Yeah. So it really led me down a dark path. The boyfriend that I was with broke up with me because he really just couldn't get over the fact that I quote cheated on him. Even though I was, you know, trying to desperately make it up to him with, you know, acts of sexual service. Which didn't feel good. It all just felt really gross and ugly. Like since that time, I've never felt as dirty about myself as I felt then. Mm-hmm. Like I just felt used. So I began like having just really just random sexual I can't even say that word. Just random guys that would come into my life. Mm-hmm. I would just start, you know, dating them, or we wouldn't date and we just, you know, hang out, you know, be physical in some way. And it wasn't done out of a curiosity standpoint. It was just done out of like self-destruction. Mm-hmm. I just felt awful about myself. So when I was 18, I actually got pregnant with my first child, and my parents forbid me to see the father. So they didn't like him. He went to my church. He wasn't an awful guy. He wasn't great. And he was just really, he's an 18-year-old person. Like neither one of us were equipped for, you know, a pregnancy, let alone raising a child. I wasn't really given an option on what to do with the child. Because of my fundamental beliefs, you know, abortion was ruled out like immediately. So adoption was the one choice. If I had kept the child and kicked out of my house, as it was a very tense and awful time during those 9 months. So we chose for adoption, and I found a family in Houston that I was going to place her with. So she was born in March of 2001, and I had placed her for adoption. We did an open adoption, so I actually just got done visiting my daughters, and I went down to Houston to go visit her. So it's still a relationship that is there and fostered and nurtured. So she's still very much in my life, but mm-hmm. It was definitely a very hard decision that I look back on and go, like, I don't think that was handled all completely well.
It's hard to digest all of this, you know, what you went through in terms of like the shame you must have felt, and then having a child and having to make these decisions kind of out of your own will. Mm-hmm. And so much of it to me speaks of like a real compromise of your autonomy and your agency to make decisions for yourself, but to even know, like, what are the right decisions? Because everybody's just telling you, you know, you're wrong, you're bad, or
yeah. I was deep, deep in shame. Like, even one Sunday morning, I was used as an example from the sermon, like as a don't do this.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Pulpit shamed.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So let me ask you, okay, at this point you have your daughter, she's adopted. And then you're still in this environment for a while, or were you able, like, when did you start kind of waking up or having the ability to like make steps away from this?
Yeah. So, I had her in March of 2001, and things were really, really tense at home. They were not great at all, for so many reasons. And I really, looking back on it, I didn't give myself enough time to grieve. Like, you have a baby, you have all those postpartum hormones going through your body. You don't have a baby. There's like a grieving of loss, and you've got this, pull yourself together. You brought this upon yourself kind of attitude coming from your family and coming from your church. And I knew I needed to get out of there. And, you know, like lately, as I've been reflecting on this time, I've been super proud of myself at how quickly I was able to recognize this is not a safe environment for me. I need to get out. And in August of 2001, I moved to Austin to go to college. And so it was just in that time that I was like, I need to leave. Like, this isn't healthy for me. And I wasn't in a place where I was healthy either, but I at least got out of the situation. And so I left home at 19 to go to college, and I didn't go back.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That takes so much courage. I mean, to be able to recognize, like, this isn't safe, I need to get out. I've met other people who have left cults too. And it's, I look at that and I think, wow, like, it's really remarkable that you're able to take that risk and just kind of like create a life on your own, right? Like your entire support system. And I mean, yeah, they were supportive in one sense and totally not supportive in another, but that was everything familiar to you.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, walk us through like what happened after that.
Yeah. So, I got down to Austin in, August, and of course, like, I'm not in a good headspace. Like, I just get down there. I've lost, pretty much my entire network of support. I'm in a new city that I had never lived in before. I've only really ever known Dallas. So it was very different for me. I was excited to be on my own, but at the same time, I just wanted somebody to accept me, you know? And I was fortunate enough to meet, my husband, pretty quickly after I came to Austin. And I really was not interested in a relationship at all. Just coming out of this time, I knew it was just not time for a relationship. But he just kept, you know, talking to me, being my friend. And the thing that he did is he validated me. Mm. I had never heard things like when I told him my story, I was like, look, this is who I am. This is what I just got out of. I had a baby. I'm 19 years old. I'm in a dorm right now. And you'd kind of like, I said it to him in a way that was like hoping he would just throw me away like everyone else kind of had. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he had this smile. He's like, that's just part of your story. It's okay. Mm-hmm. And he's never held it over my head. He's never put that shame on me. It was acceptance from day one. And I knew this guy was different than I had ever seen anywhere else. And we ended up having like a 2-year relationship where we dated and then eventually we got married. But in March of 2003, we got engaged, and like a week later we found out we were pregnant with my oldest daughter, Hannah. Mm-hmm. And so here we go again with my parents in the fundamental church. Again, I'm in Austin at the time, so like I'm able to have like a buffer. I'd begun some, like a smidge of the healing process, but I really wasn't totally there yet. And we decided to get married in May in the church that I grew up in. Looking back at it, I'm like, why did we do that? Like, there was still like emotional connections. I think, you know, like I do a lot of like, reading and listening to stories about people who have like exited cults, and you know, like there's a sense of belonging there. Like even though they treat you like trash, there's like this emotional connection there sometimes that, you know, gets the better of us. And so we got married in that church, and we, about 2 days before the wedding, the pastor called me and said that they were going to have to do a forgiveness of, like a public forgiveness of sins, absolution, at the wedding. And so here I am, like all my family's in town, you know, my husband's from Denver, so like all his family's in town, and we've got flowers and caterers and dresses and all this stuff happening, and I can't back out. Like I'm like, we have to just keep plugging forward. And so we had this like thing that we had to say that basically it said like, because Kelly and Sean have entered into a sinful relationship and have conceived a child, you know, they have dishonored their family and are asking for forgiveness of sins. And we had to go all through this at the altar during our wedding.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's so unbelievable. I mean, okay. So I'm a little speechless here. So And so you're like basically displaying the shame that they're putting on you to the world, to the whole congregation.
Yes.
Kind of like, I don't know, I'm thinking about, you know, people who are maybe burned at the stake or like the Scarlet Letter. It's like, come look at this example of what you should not do.
And yes.
Point yes. fingers. And it's just like so wrong. It's so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, like, how did you get through that?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously it was really, really hard. We stayed in Austin. We had, our oldest daughter, Hannah, and, we honestly, it was really hard, Carrie. It was really, really hard. Not only was I still dealing with the shame of all that, I was learning how to be a mom and a wife kind of all at the same time. And it was really, really hard. But I don't know, my daughter's 19 now. And I always tell her she was, you know, we grew up with her. Like, it was around the time that I was 30. I was just about to turn 30 and she was about 8. We'd been married for about 7 or 8 years. And I kind of hit this breaking point where I was like, I need to go get some help and talk through this. And I spent the next 2 or 3 years in counseling. And I was going to some pretty intense counseling therapy services where I was seeing them, you know, once, twice a week, and then going to group therapy as well. And so I was just really, really determined to kind of get through this and understand, like, so that I didn't go back, you know, I didn't want to go back. And I wanted to heal for my kids and my family. I wanted to heal for them. You know, I really wanted to heal for myself. I wanted to be me, not who the church told me I needed to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and I want to pause and go back to something that you said earlier, which was that throughout this whole process or this experience, you got zero validation mm-hmm. for what you were going through. And this is what happens when people gaslight other people. There's not the ability to even acknowledge your own experience or be curious about it. It's just project, and we need to maintain our control or our system, and this is how we'll do it at your expense. So you had zero validation, and then you met your husband who was able to finally offer that to you, which mm-hmm. I think that is such a point of healing for so many people to finally have a space where it's like, I'm accepted for who I am, for what I've done, what I've been through, and I'm okay. Like, they're telling me I'm okay, mm-hmm. which then creates the safety for you to then express more of yourself and to like shed the shame and probably integrate into yourself, like becoming not judgmental like those people were to you. That was very clear to me as you're telling this story of like, you weren't allowed the opportunity or the space to have any validation for what it was like for you. And finally you received that, which took you kind of further away from the unsafe territory. Mm-hmm. But it's, you still had work to do. So I guess I'm wondering, like you said, you were in therapy for a couple of years. What else have you had to do, or how has it been like to like literally heal yourself from all of the trauma you experienced and kind of become, you and I joke about this, but like born again?
Yeah.
In a religious way, but in this like real, true, authentic way.
Exactly. You know, I'll say it's definitely still a journey. You know, it's now, I've been out of therapy now, I'm 41. So I've been out for, you know, 7, 8 years. And I'm still learning things. There's still moments where I wake up and go, oh yeah, I hadn't thought about it like that. Or, wow, that situation gave me the power to do X, Y, Z. And so I would say I'm still learning and growing, but you know, the last 10 years has been really phenomenal. we went through a season where Sean and I really had to work on our marriage. So it was like we healed individually, and then we had some issues marriage-wise that then we had to deal with. I really felt like I was changing and growing as a person when I was going through all that counseling, and it really changed the dynamic in our marriage as well. And so we worked on that. And now, I would say probably since about 2018, it's just been fantastic. Like, I feel like I can be myself. We can be ourselves together as a family. I've seen our family just, grow and feel safe. And that's been just some of the fruit of all this work that we've done. One of the kickers of this whole thing is, I went into a career in ministry. So shortly after I had my daughter, I started working in kids ministry and became the kids director. And then it's just sort of expanded from there to my eventual position where my last church was at. I was a communication director. And so it's interesting, like my reason for being in the church was I was thinking, if I can just help one person, if I can just be a listening ear for one person who went through something horrible, then it will make this whole thing worth it. Like I really wanted to help and be there for someone who wasn't there for me. And I really thought I could do that within the church. But as I saw more hurt upon hurt mounting up in the church, and I would try to advocate for these people, there would inevitably be people above me that would squash it. And I just found myself really feeling like I was constantly bucking a system that wouldn't let me help others. So I would say, you know, it was kind of odd, like around the same ish time, I started deconstructing as my husband. We really didn't have any conversations about it or anything. It was just kind of something that both of us were sort of, you know, melding inside our brains. And then, I made a comment. I was like, yeah, I don't think I'd probably go to church after the kids are grown up. And, you know, like he was like, yeah, I'm kind of thinking about that too. And really during 2020, we really used that time to kind of deconstruct and figure out, like, do we even want to still be part of a church system? Do we want our children to be part of a church system? And at the time, like our oldest daughter, Hannah, had said that she was an atheist and didn't want to go to church anymore. And we were like, okay, that's your choice. That's fine. And then, you know, we were kind of all working on deconstructing our own stuff with the church. And so ultimately we decided, you know, like, hey, this isn't really for us anymore as a family. So,
wow.
You know, if our kids want to go, we will help them, but because I don't want to be a hindrance if they are, but none of them really want to be a part. So,
yeah. Well, yes. And your story, it illustrates something clearly to me about how you were saying how you're trying to support and help these people within the religious system, but that you couldn't, like you could only go so far. And I don't know that this is like an absolute, but I do see that typically in a system, like it has to maintain some kind of control and order in order for it to continue as it is. And too many differences or too many like critical thoughts or something outside of what is like considered okay for them, it can be threatening to the system itself. And so oftentimes it will squeeze those people out. And that's so unfortunate because it's a closed system then, and it will become stagnant and it doesn't have life to it. So I think on one hand, it's really cool that you were trying to help people within that context, but also like at a certain point, you got to fold your cards and say, my efforts aren't worth the energy that I'm expending here. Let me take it elsewhere. And I, yes. Even as you're just telling your story, I'm thinking this is helping people, right? Like just for your story to be a source of validation to others who have gone through something similar or are in that position, it's to say that, you know, you're not alone and you're okay and acceptable as you are. So I just want to point that out. I think you are doing it. And kudos to you for taking your energy elsewhere, because it clearly was not going anywhere.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You can't change the system. The system is so deep ingrained in everything. I mean, you've got years and years of history and church theology and scholars and all that. I don't mean to discourage anyone who wants to go out and change the world, but it's going to take more than one person.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Well, and I want to believe too, like, you know, you were in a more extreme version, I think, of a religious system. And there, mm-hmm. I think that there are some faith communities that are thriving a little more and attentive to the individual's needs and not yes. so judgmental or shaming. So I do think it's on a spectrum, but at the same time, like you did, you have to analyze, like, is what the cost to stay here, is it worth it, you know? Or maybe is there something on the other side, a reward for me? Like for you, it sounds like was this coming back to yourself and releasing the shame and feeling whole again. Like that's the reward. So you have to constantly like analyze, and you may not know entirely if the rewards will outweigh the cost until you take that step out. But it is worth asking whatever system or institutional construct that you might find yourself in.
Yeah.
So wow, you've come so far. You really have.
And thank you.
Yeah, I just think it's such a remarkable story that took so much courage to pull yourself out of this mountain of shame that you were put under. So, I mean, I guess if someone was listening and they feel stuck in either a toxic religious or work or relationship environment, like what would be the first thing you would say to them?
Wow. Yeah, it's hard. It is so hard. And just find one person, just one person that you can trust, that will accept you for who you are, that will listen to your story, that will validate, because that, I think people get so crippled by the emotional weight of that, of a cult type fundamental religion. And just having one person to listen to them can be enough energy to pick yourself up and get out, you know, mm-hmm. or at least take a step forward. And then soon find a second person, you know, and before you know it, you've built a community, and now you're pulling out of the cult or the religion and into a safe community that can accept and love you for who you are.
That's
give you a space to heal too.
Yes. That's, you're so spot on. I think all it takes is one person, right? And I think, you know, as I look at other people's stories, my own, oftentimes if it's like when you can find an authentic person who already like they're free in a certain way. And then, I don't know, I find myself drawn to those types of people. And that kind of creates that sense of trust right away. It's like, well, you can sense that they trust themselves, so I can probably trust them too. And then they can kind of nurture you along that path of leaving the toxicity, of leaving, you know, the sham of all the lies and the rules that have been told to you. So
yes.
I think that's fantastic advice. And sometimes, you know, even in a therapist or a coach, or just that, I think that's the goal that so many of those people try to create, is a safe space to be accepted for who you are. So if you don't have that in your circle, kind of thinking more on a professional level, go find that.
Yes.
So, well, I think you have been on this, like, what I call the hero's journey. It's just amazing when you see like somebody who has struggled for a large part of their life to listen to what's happening inside and to make those choices. They call it like heeding the call, right? The invitation to something bigger, something better. And you don't know where it's going to lead you, but you just kind of like intuit that it's going to be better than what it's been. And that to me is what you've done. And those are always the most inspiring stories. So I really appreciate your level of vulnerability in sharing all of this because, you know, I think on some level it probably heals ourselves, but other people too can receive from the sharing of that. So,
yeah.
Well, so before we tie up our time, Kelly, I'm going to ask you the two questions I ask all my guests, which is first one, what are you up to these days that you're excited about?
Yeah. So I left my position at the church actually back in August, to really like let go, like just, you know, I felt like I was kind of faking it there in the last couple of years. And so really just began to be myself. I'm Carrie said at the beginning, owner, CEO of Gold Bear Media. We're a full service marketing service, that does websites, social media management, SEO, blog writing, a whole bunch of things. Really, if you can think of it, we can probably do it. I have a great team of people around me that are highly skilled in lots of different areas. And I've just really, really enjoyed getting to know the people that I've gotten to know through this business. We started in January of 2020 as a very part-time. I was taking on some clients, but of course still had a full-time job. And so had to kind of balance that time along with my family. So I'm really excited the last couple months being able to lean into this full-time. I've met some awesome people, including you, Carrie, and just hearing lots of different stories and helping these small businesses or startups just get going. It's been cool to be part of their stories.
Yes, I am going to be preaching you to everybody. Like I've told you, your work you have so much wisdom and knowledge, and I just think the relationship aspect that you provide your clients and your customers is like the best that I've experienced. So
Thank you.
I'm just going to like keep singing your praises. I'm glad you brought that up. So, which segues into my next question, which is how can people get in touch with you or more of your content or your business? Is it through website or social?
Yeah. So my website is goldbear.media and I'm on Instagram pretty much all day. So you can DM me through my Instagram profile, which is goldbear.media. And so that is the two places that that I would love to connect with anybody. I kind of tell people I'm a cheerleader. I feel like I love to cheer on small business owners, really give them the tools and encouragement to take the next step in their business. And so, yeah, I love meeting people, even just talking to them. So,
Yes, you are so good at cheering people on. You really are. And
thank you.
Yeah. So Kelly, I'm going to go ahead and link your info in the show notes so people can access that and see more of your business and who you are. And truly, it has been such an honor and pleasure to just kind of like be witness to your candid story and your thoughts about, you know, what it means to take these brave risks to literally be born into somebody new, right? Like someone who's truly authentic and you're apart from these systems and the rules that tell us who we should be. So I'm so grateful for your transparency and your vulnerability and just putting yourself out there and offering your time today. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, everyone, in the meantime, I invite you to check out Kelly on her website and on Instagram. And I encourage you to just think about what might be waiting for you on the other side of this important work of healing yourself and discovering who you truly are.
If this episode resonated with you, I have something you are going to love. As you may know, part of what helps me live connected to myself is embracing a life full of pleasure and adventure. Building a coaching business centered on pleasure has sparked many of my clients to their own success while offering me the purpose of getting to do what I love every day. If you're curious about what it means to add more excitement in your life, I have a free resource for 5 ways to cultivate pleasure to give you simple steps to start walking you toward a life that feels so good. I'll link it in the show notes, so definitely check it out if you're interested. I'm so glad you joined us, and remember to stay connected.